It is my pleasure to introduce to you Brad and Jesse Smith, who are speakers and authors for Save the One and founders of the pro-life blog, Little Faith to Big Faith. Though their pro-life views were developed long before their marriage and children, Brad and Jesse Smith's fifth child, Faith, tested and ultimately strengthened those views. Faith was diagnosed in the womb with fatal fetal anomalies, and after birth was genetically tested and found to have trisomy 18 and monosomy 21. They endured the pressures to abort Faith, the pressure to not treat Faith throughout her childhood, and continue the battle to get proper medical treatment for her. Brad and Jesse now travel the country for Save the One, a pro-life organization dedicated to saving the 1% of children conceived in rape, incest, and with so-called fetal-fatal anomalies. They share their family story to challenge society's bizarre and murderous mission to wipe the disabled from the face of the earth. Their topic, the extinction of the disabled through abortion and lethal neglect.
Well, thank you so much. We are really happy to be here. It's an honor for us to be able to come here and share our story with you folks. We started doing this. We're part of Save the One. So we started doing this, just over a couple of years ago at Rebecca Kiesling, who many of you might have just heard, at her pushing. And it was one of those things when we first started, we didn't really want to do it, but then we saw how people were responding to what we said, and we knew that God had led us to do this and use Rebecca to get us to do it. So we just want to start by telling you we have five kids, if I can do five kids. I was going to make a joke there, but I won't, based upon Molly's stuff. But I'll stay away from that.
Did it have to do with the pollinating?
It had something to do with the cross-pollination. Anyway, our youngest is Faith. And when we were told that we were pregnant, you know, you go through the ultrasounds, all the stuff you do with that. We went to an ultrasound, and they saw some what they consider soft signs. And they started looking at these different things. They said, well, we see cysts on the brain. We see calcification in the heart. We, you know, they're pointing at all these different things. And they sent us to a geneticist to have genetics counseling. And so we went in to meet this doctor, and he starts telling us that, you know, here are the things we see, and we think you might be facing a number of different things. One of them was trisomy 18 that he named. And when he did, he suggested that we should have an amniocentesis. And my wife she loves the research, and so she had looked at this, and she saw an amniocentesis. It's a small percentage, but it can cause a miscarriage. And so she looked at that. We knew beforehand going in that was something we weren't interested in. So we said, no, thanks. And he said, no, I really think you should have it. Well, we kind of get a feeling of where he's going with this. So we pushed him and said, really? So what, I mean, can you do anything? Can you fix the problem if you find it? Well, no. Well, then what's the reason? Well, if you want to terminate. Well, at that point, the two of us, and I'm not joking when I said, identically at the same time responded with the exact same words and said, that is not an option. Said it in unison. And this doctor came back, even after that, two more times he pushed us to get testing so we could abort our child, even after telling him it wasn't an option. So,
well, this is where I really need to take over the story, because my husband, have you ever seen angry eyes on people? He just was ready to jump out of his chair. So we literally had to wrap this appointment up and leave. But before we left, he was telling us that our daughter would have a life that was... I don't need this, do I?
I don't know if he's got that on or not.
Okay, well, I'll take this. Anyway, a life... She said she didn't have a life worth living, that she would be severely disabled, that it would ruin our other children. It would ruin our family, our finances, our marriage. I mean, really, we left there. I was bawling. I'm an ugly crier too. So it's out my eyes, out my nose. And we just sat in the van. I don't know. It was like an hour afterward. He is fuming and I am sobbing. I mean, this is the type we left there with no hope. And trisomy 18, I don't know, did you say what it was? It's very similar to Down syndrome. So it means you have an extra chromosome. All your chromosomes, you'll have two. Well, this is a third one. And a lot of times it presents itself just, you know, some of these kids have organs on the outside of their body. They don't make it out of the womb at all. And so it is a harsh diagnosis. And he wasn't sure, though, because this was off a routine ultrasound. So we didn't even get the rest of the prenatal tests, thank God. We now call them search and destroy missions, because what happens is they're identifying the disabled children simply to get rid of them, not to help. I mean, haven't we done this already? Wasn't that World War II that we said, hey, let's make our own master race? But now we are killing our way there. And in my view, I think we're getting rid of the best among us, the happiest, the sweetest, the most lovely, and the ones that teach us about our own humanity.
So, you know, we leave there, we go out, we're sitting in the car, as she said. And one of the things I just got to tell is as we were talking, I just looked at her and I said, we have a Grace and a Hope, our two older daughters. We also have an Elijah and a Gideon.
We marked them all. We want them to serve God.
I think that's working. So as I looked there, I said, you know, I hate to say this, because we had talked about, you know, what name to go with. And we didn't want to do the Grace, Hope, and you know. And I looked there and I went, I know what it has to be. It's got to be Faith. And she still wasn't sold.
I'm a tough sell.
But we got two phone calls, or she got the phone calls, one from my mom and one from sister-in-law. And both of them called and said, you know, we just want to let you know we're praying for you. And that not to push you or anything, but we're praying for a little Faith. And they both called her separately. And she finally went, okay. So there we were, facing this problem, what was considered a death sentence and is labeled incompatible with life. I want you to get that. The doctors say incompatible with life, that your child, there's no way she's going to live.
Well, and it's a very strange thing, because they say your child's going to die, but then they want to hasten their death. You know what I mean? So it seems so odd that here we are saying the imminent death is coming. Then why do we have to hasten it? Why do we have to help them get there? It seems like a good waste of time and medical dollars to me. But to them, the worst type of tyranny, I think C.S. Lewis said it this way, is the kind that they're doing it for your own good. And so they think in a very deceitful way, oh, we're helping them. We're helping them to die. So
they were, this doctor, even though we couldn't stand him, he was right about one thing. Faith did have trisomy 18. And frankly, it was the worst thing we could have heard. Now, when she was born, remember, we didn't do any testing. We didn't have a diagnosis of trisomy 18. So when she was born, everybody's looking at her going, what is it? What could it be? You know, you could hear the nurses whispering.
Yeah, where the other children that we had, I mean, I've been through this. Now this is my fifth child. You know, you're counting fingers and toes and you're looking at them, but there wasn't the awe and congratulations. Now I'm hearing the nurses take her and whisper in the corner of the room. And you can see the features, a web neck, lower set ears, recessed jaw, clenched hands. These are all indicative of trisomy 18. If you're familiar with it, it is easy to see, like Down syndrome would be. But so they are all looking at this and the room gets simply quiet.
Now, at this point, one of the doctors heard something not right. They had checked her heart through all these ultrasounds, and frankly, the calcification that they saw, it disappeared. A number of the other things had disappeared, that they were the cysts on the brain, all had disappeared. And so, in fact, they didn't see this in the womb when they were looking at her heart, but she had a hole. It was so large, and when they heard, there was no murmur. When you have a hole in the heart, usually it creates a murmur, and that's how they can tell. That's the first sign of it. They'll listen, they hear the murmur, and they'll go check and find the hole. Hers was so big, there was no murmur. So this cardiologist comes in. Again, there's no trisomy 18 diagnosis at this point. All right, so you got to understand where we're at with this. He looks at her as a child, and he says to us, you know, if you've got to have heart surgery, this is the kind to have. So don't worry. We can take care of this. It's a one-and-done surgery, and you'll never have to go back and do anything. So we're like, okay, that's great. We appreciate that. Well, we then get the actual diagnosis. Later on, we're at our pediatrician's office. We get a diagnosis of the trisomy 18, which again, you're seeing this stuff. This is living this over a couple weeks where it's another devastating blow to us because it's something we didn't want to hear. Well, everything we had read was horrible.
And this is something, if you're dealing with moms that are getting this diagnosis, I've never wanted to die before. I wanted to die here, not because I wanted her to be gone, but I felt crushed. And this is something that these women are feeling at this time. I wanted her to live, but I thought, I can't. In fact, I cried at one appointment. I can't go to one more and hear one more bit of bad news. But oddly enough, it was a friend of ours that had done two tours in Iraq, and he said something that just lifted me. And I don't know if this will help any of you, but he said, "You haven't went through anything hard enough if you hadn't wanted to die yet." And for some reason, that took the weight of that off me, and I thought, okay, God has us going through this hard time, and it was like those olives being pressed and made into oil and the grain that must be ground to make bread. God had a purpose even in the crushing in this. And so when you're dealing with women like this and they have this, don't think that this is just dust that will go into the ground. God makes beauty out of ashes. And as we go on, I hope you see that in our story.
So we go see this cardiologist. This is like 2 weeks later after he had initially seen her. Now we have a trisomy 18 diagnosis. All right. He looks at her that first time and says, "We can fix the heart." This time when we go in, he's printed out a stack of papers from the internet. Literally, just printed them. They were hot off the press. And he starts walking through with us, here's what you're facing. She's got trisomy 18. She's going to go into heart failure. He starts describing how she will, through the heart failure, that she will essentially drown to death slowly because her lungs will fill with fluid. And so, he's making this as graphic as can be. And he says, where he was willing to do something before, he's all of a sudden now he's going, "I don't know if we should do anything. I don't know if you should put her through this heart surgery because, And he starts telling us that they don't do well. These children don't do well, which isn't actually true.
I think as a parent, when you are faced with certain death or the possibility of life, this was not a hard decision as parents for us to go, yes, if she can live, let's do something. Let's help her. And at the time, I'm taking her out, and she's literally panting. And so people would stop when we're out, and I only made it really to doctor's appointments. They're stopping and asking, "Is she okay? And, she looks so small, and why is she doing that?" And, I didn't know any of the answers. I'm like, "Oh, God, help," And you're just stuck in that. And to hear the doctor say this, again, hope is being pulled from you.
And that is what they did. There's this stripping of hope that goes on. And so what comes next, though, from this guy's mouth is what's so telling. Because he walks through all this stuff about how we shouldn't do anything and that she's probably not going to make it. But then he says, "If you really want to do the surgery, I might be willing to do it." Well, that sounds horrible, but I got to tell you, I've learned now from working with doctors, he never would have said that if he wasn't willing to do it. But he was setting us up for the next line, which was, "If you do want to do the surgery, we're going to have to go before an ethics committee." This was back when everyone was making fun of Sarah Palin when she was talking about death panels. It was in 2009, exact same time. Everyone's making fun of every, all this stuff about the death panels. And I'm sitting here going, "They want to send me to one? Are you kidding me? I know they exist." Now, her sister was pushing us, didn't like what she was seeing. And actually she has a special needs son and she deals with Boston Children's and has some doctors that she trusts there. So she started pushing and found a name of a doctor another cardiologist that we could go see. But we just wanted to get the heck out of there at that point. And not trusting these doctors, we, have to show you a few pictures of just how our
children.
That
one's a freebie because we love showing off our kids. So we're going to make you look at all their pictures.
But this doctor was at Mott Children's Hospital. This is the University of Michigan, okay? So Mott Children's Hospital, I'm from Ohio. I live in Michigan, but I'm from Ohio. Anyway, we take her to see this cardiologist at Mott. And she looks at her, and at this point, they're hearing a murmur, which I kept telling Jess, nobody's touching her heart. And I just keep saying, this thing's growing closed. Nobody's touching this kid's heart. And when they look at it, they said, this is a large, she's 2 months old at this point. This is a large hole, and it's going to need surgery. She'll probably, at 4 months old, so 2 months later, she'll need to have surgery. So we're going to keep a close eye on her. We want you to come back in another month. So we take her home. We're going through all this hard stuff, just trying to feed her and do all the stuff that we're trying to do. We're sleep deprived, all the crazy stuff that goes with it. We go back to the appointment at her third month appointment. And when we get into that appointment, you know, we're just waiting, wanting to hear what's going on. The doctor walks in. She looks at us and she says, she kind of gets this little smile and she says, the hole is small. The pressures are in the range they need to be, and you don't need heart surgery. I mean, God is good. Let me tell you, he can do whatever he wants. He can balance her chromosomes if he wants to. So
I want to say one thing. Our pediatrician at this time, unbeknownst to us, dropped us. So our cardiologist is trying to set up, some care for our daughter. And she goes, your pediatrician doesn't really want to help anymore. I think what we have done to our medical industry, and this was our first experience with it, was not only will they not help, it's they can't anymore. Because we have so pushed it that some people are not worth treating, that they have not practiced medicine. They have not practiced treating the sick. And so they're very uncomfortable. I remember taking Faith in not long ago last year for an ear infection. And there's, you guys have been to those urgent care places. You can go in and, they do a quick assessment. She has an ear infection. I know what it is. Her finger is sticking in her ear and she's whining like this. Because they don't often see kids like Faith. They wanted us to go right to the ER. So you can't even get general care from general doctors anymore because they're killing their own industry by not treating the sick.
And just to kind of give you an idea of what really goes on, this is another little friend that we met. Now, we met them later on, so we hadn't actually met them at this point, but you'll understand why I'm bringing it in here. Because this family, little Maristella, they were at the same initial hospital we were at. They didn't have someone pushing them to get out of that hospital and saying, don't trust them. So when they were told they had to go before an ethics committee, they said, okay. So they decided, we're going to do this. We're going to go before the ethics committee. They show up for the meeting. They weren't going to be allowed into the meeting. The parents.
Well, that's until the father, who is in the military and also knows how to yell really well in Italian, was able to yell in Italian until they let them in.
So they did let them in. And let me tell you, obviously, it's a whole lot harder to say no with a parent sitting there.
Yeah.
They didn't want them there because they wanted to say no. But they agreed to do the heart surgery. So they went through this, did the heart surgery, successful heart surgery. Now, here's the amazing thing. These doctors, this hospital, came back to these parents after doing successful heart surgery and told them, we just want to make sure you understand that this does not mean that we are willing to do this for any other children with trisomy 18. They were successful, and they weren't willing to do it. They got their bill paid, and they weren't willing to do it. So this hospital clearly, as you can see now, this hospital clearly has a policy because here's a cardiologist that we saw and he was willing to treat us if we really wanted to do it, but immediately told us we'd have to go before an ethics committee. Here's another family who did go before the ethics committee. And so this hospital's policy automatically with trisomy 18, and we've got another friend in Michigan that he wasn't doing well. They tried to transfer to this hospital, and when they found out that he had trisomy 18, they denied the transfer. So they don't take, and what's scary about this is this is the majority. This is the way most of these children are treated by most hospitals.
Well, and these policies are like a hidden net. You don't know they're there. You don't even know you're caught because you don't know what you don't know. You know, you're trusting, paying them to deliver something. And what we found is it's not just with the physically and mentally disabled. You have this with the elderly. You have this. Even I've read a lot of medical journals now trying to advocate better for my daughter. And what I found is even somebody who's single and is in the hospital receives just less care. I mean, you almost have to go and tell them how valuable this person is. But when we value one, if we are allowed to devalue one person's life, it affects us all. It's like that Martin Niemöller from World War II that said, you know, when they came for the trade unionist, I didn't say anything because I wasn't a trade unionist. When they came for the communist, I didn't say anything. And they came for the Jew, I didn't say anything, I wasn't a Jew. And then they came for me and no one was left to speak. And so they're seeing these people alone, uncared for. If they didn't get them in the womb and pressure you there, they're not treating them after. And that devaluing of life is affecting us all in the medical industry for sure.
Now, at this point where, you know, Faith makes it through, she doesn't have to have the heart surgery. And somehow, frankly, we don't know how, but she had not really gotten sick. And we hadn't really faced a lot of things at this point. But we also had met a whole lot of other people dealing with this, because 90% of these children are aborted in the womb. 90%. I just want you to grasp that. If you have 100 children that are diagnosed with trisomy 18, only 10 of them make it out of the womb alive. Now, the stats get even worse, because only 10% of those that make it out of the womb alive reach their first birthday. So that means out of that 100, we're now down to one. One child that lives and actually makes it to their first birthday. So getting help is important with this, and we just happened to get a little help from a friend who also has a child with trisomy 18.
He was actually the first person we met. Gosh, we picked a national figure to find the first person we met. But he was so important for Faith even being alive. Remember, the doctors, we didn't know what we didn't know. They're not telling us. And
when we met him, we met him actually a few months, it was in the spring. And as we were talking to him, we walked out of there, and this guy spent, it was hilarious, because it was a fundraising event. You know, he was just getting ready to run for president, and he spent all his time with us.
And holding Faith, and let me tell you, as a mom of a child with special needs, nobody asked to hold her. I mean, she looked medical, and she was always hooked up to something, and even family. They just, you know, that you're scared, and I don't, think anything poorly, but this man picked up my daughter. And I think, we just saw the love and compassion there.
And I got to say this other thing, because this was just wild. As we're standing there talking to him, this is before the event started, he says, "You've got to speak to my wife." So he pulls out, when Blackberries were still around, he pulls out his Blackberry, calls her up on the phone, gets her on, and hands the phone to Jesse and says, "Here, take this." Then Jesse's talking. And they come over and start bugging him, because he's got to speak. He's the speaker for the event. So they come over and grab him and say, "We got to go." And he looks at us. He goes, "I'll come get it later. Don't worry about it." He left his cell phone with us.
I only talked to his wife. I didn't take selfies or anything.
But in meeting him, when we walked out of there that night, I looked at Jesse and I said, "I don't know what it is, but God just introduced us to this man." And I couldn't explain it, but I knew that we had just been introduced to him. So Faith gets sick a few months later. This is the first time she's really gotten sick, but she's very sick. She goes downhill fast. And this is like a Memorial Labor Day weekend. And the hospital kind of, you know, they work with us and they nurse her back to health. And so, you know, here she is, she's feeling good. But then she gets sick again. She goes back downhill. And at this point, we're, you know, even with this, we're already starting to see, well, this is a problem. What's going on? And just so happens, that when she went back in the hospital the second time, Rick Santorum at that time had been filling in for Bill Bennett's Morning in America. I don't know if many of you listen to it, but I work for Salem Media and manage the sales in Detroit. And so he, in doing this, every Friday, Rick would fill in for Bill, and he just happened to be in town on a Friday because he needed to do a political event for a friend of ours. So, amazingly, he had to come to our studios to do that. So, he gets done with his program, and he's busy. He's got to get out of there. So, he's walking out, and I grab him, and I stop him, and I said, Rick, here's what's happening. Our daughter's in the hospital. She was just sick. She's, we nursed her back. She's sick again. Any thoughts, any ideas? So, he starts walking through all these things with me. Give me a list of things. Here's what you should be doing. Boom, 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 boom. And I'm just kind of like, huh? Because I hadn't heard any of this from a doctor. Nothing. None of the things that he's saying had doctors suggested to us. And I was skeptical because you trust doctors, don't you? You trust them that they're actually giving you everything. So I was a little skeptical, and he could see that I was skeptical. And he stopped, and he looks at me, and he says, if you don't do this for your daughter, you're going to lose her. That grabbed my attention. I started listening at that point, and so did my boss, because he came running over, had a pad and a pen of paper, and he started writing. Rick starts walking back through all the stuff. He starts writing it all down. So now we have this little list that Rick is saying, you've got to do this stuff. So I leave from lunch and go over to the hospital with my list. And we walk in and give it to the doctors.
Yeah, and basically they said, nobody does this. We're like, now we're name dropping shamelessly. You know, oh yes, Rick Santorum over, in Philadelphia, they do this. No, nobody does this. So they wouldn't do it. And we are very slow learners, evidently, because, of course, we're on this path where she gets they get her a little bit better. She goes back down, gets her a little bit better. Well, now we are at election day, and Brad just leaves for work, and I wake up, and I'm going to get Faith up, and I look in, and she's gray, and I thought she was dead. I couldn't tell, and I did. Oh, I'm just the worst in an emergency, evidently, because I got her up to take a bath. I was like, oh, I'm going to wake her up, because she's just had so many problems and stuff, and she always felt better in the bath. So I'm putting her in the bath. Now, the normal thing that people should have done is maybe oxygen or resuscitation or something. No, that's what I do. And I don't call 911. I call my husband. Who does this? They always tell you. And as a little child, they say, call 911. No, I call my husband because he's going to help. So
it's election day. And I had just left, and I had voted. And so I wasn't far away. So I turned around and flew back to the house. And I ran in, ran upstairs, and she's right. She was gray, and all I could see, she couldn't move a muscle. Her eyes were open. She could not blink. She could not move her eyeballs. She was just staring straight ahead. She looked dead, other than the fact that her little chest was just going up and down. Is she was trying to breathe. And so I cranked up the oxygen, and I started blowing into her nose and trying to push air into her. And I saw that she started responding. So as she responded, I'm just like not wigging out. I tend to get a little, but the EMS comes in. They come flying up the stairs to check her out. And I just yell at them, and I said, bagger. They don't like being told what to do. But I didn't care. And I said, bagger. Because here she was sick. And I wanted this little girl to do well. And by this time, we take her, and she ends up, looking pathetic. Yeah, no, I went back to the floor. I screwed up. I could feel it when I hit it there. So my apologies. We get to this is a crazy, the whole day was crazy.
The EMS did ask why she was wet. I was like, I gave her a bath, of course, so.
But we run to the hospital. The ambulance comes, takes us to the hospital. We go to one of the hospitals near us, And this guy wanted to intubate her. And I'm like, no.
He looked scared. I mean, he looked more scared than we were. So you get a feel for people, even in the medical industry. If they look more scared than you do, you ask to be transferred to the next hospital.
So we pushed, and we got transferred to the hospital where she had been going in and out, where she had been sick. But they weren't actually doing anything. They were kind of nursing her back to health. By that night, no joke, she was a happy little camper.
And what happened was she had so much CO2 in her system because of her short jaw and small airways. Every time she got sick, she wasn't getting enough oxygen in and then couldn't get the CO2 out. And I don't know how many people have BiPAPs or CPAPs in this room. You plug them into a wall. They're about the size of a cereal box. They're really, you know, as I can to attest, any idiot can run them, you know. So it is one of those things they give people all the time. They refused to give it to our daughter. We weren't asking for even surgery at this point, just something that thousands of people are given on a routine basis. But they looked at our daughter and said, unworthy of this care.
Now, and I got to stop right here just because when we were in the hospital, we usually try to praise people publicly by name in hospitals too. We usually don't refer to the hospitals and doctors by name who were demeaning, I guess, or just telling the truth about. But we did get a picture of her with some of the doctors, and I think you can kind of tell the doctors who wanted to harm her. I can't help it. We got to have a little fun, okay? So here we are. Here she's getting sick again. So we get out of the hospital. She's going downhill again. We go back to this hospital and this doctor, and we're pushing them to give us a CPAP machine. This is the day before Thanksgiving, right? So this hospital's close to our home. So we just want to go there and get this taken care of. But we took a nurse with us. We actually had a home nurse that came with us to that meeting with the doctor. And she sat there and said, look, just give me the prescription and we'll take care of the rest. You don't have to do anything. And he said, I can't do it. I'm like, what? She starts threatening to go home with him for Thanksgiving dinner. At this point, we're pushing and pushing. And finally, she says, if you don't do this for us, we're going to have to go to Mott, which for us was an hour away. We're going to have to go to Mott for Thanksgiving and spend our Thanksgiving in the hospital. And he finally, at this point, looks and says, if I were you, I'd go to Mott. Are you kidding me? All this time, we've been going in and out of your hospital, and now you're telling us this? Now, she's furious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they talk about the mama bear instinct, but, I mean, Brad's usually like, stop. But what I did find is compassion and care are only an abstract unless you help the people right in front of you. You know, that doctor is not guaranteed to treat anybody else but the patient that he's seeing right at the moment. And so what we found was it becomes a sham, you know, to go there and you're stuck in their care. You're paying for their care and they are not telling you the truth.
Well, so what we found out doing other stuff, and I immediately, when he said, if I were you, I'd go to Mott, all of a sudden the light bulb went in my head. And I went, oh, he wants us to get out of here because he can't do anything.
And this is where the professional community of doctors is a very hard nut to crack, because there is so much professional peer pressure that if you get a diagnosis here, it's very often that nobody else will say anything, especially if they're in the same hospital. It's one thing to go to another hospital, but if they're in there and one doctor says something, everybody else is silent. I mean, really, if you look at the residents and how they even train them, it's very much like the military. No sleep. They are riding those residents. And unfortunately, unless their policy, unless our society pushes them to help and heal, then they will be doing the very opposite, which they will fall under the one or two that say, don't treat. These people aren't worth our time, money, whatever, experience. And then the whole community goes with them.
So we go to Mott, and we walk in, and we see pulmonary and all this stuff. So on Thanksgiving, and I spent my, I don't know, third Thanksgiving at Mott Children's Hospital. But the nice thing was we walked in, we talked to this doctor. She looks at us, and when we said they wouldn't give us a CPAP, she said, why not?
I still hug that doctor every time I see her for that word to us, you know, why not? Yes, why not my daughter?
So you look at this and you go, could you not just take care of our child? Well, they helped us. Finally, we found a group of doctors that were willing to help us. And just so you understand, this is the only hospital in Michigan that I can say would really help. Everywhere else, we try to pull parents out of there and get them away. But in that, when we went, they had to do some other stuff. And this is, let me show you this. You got to understand this. This is a side profile of Faith. If you look at her, can you see the short jaw? You see the double chin? Okay, so here's this little girl with this short jaw, and nobody has ever said a word to us. Again, they wouldn't give us a CPAP. Nobody's ever mentioned her short jaw until one doctor looked at her at Mott. And his name is Dr. Glenn Green, and he is an ENT and an amazing ENT at Mott. And he looked at her and said, she needs a jaw distraction. She's 3 years old almost at this point. I mean, days away from being three. And this is the first time we've heard this.
Although I've went back, it wasn't all of her medical records. So I have the medical records from the two previous hospitals. Everybody noted it, but did not tell us.
So we agreed to do this jaw distraction. It really was something that we didn't want to do. And I kept praying, oh God, just grow her jaw.
Yeah, we knew we had to go through it though.
But it was one of those things, you know, I looked at him like, God, you healed her heart, grow her jaw. But as we prayed about it, we both knew this is what we were supposed to do. We needed to go through this surgery. And so we agreed to it. And they did the surgery. And as they did this stuff, all kinds of stuff happened. Literally, the day of surgery.
Oh, if there's a bump in the road medically, she will hit it and hit it full on. Every time I meet a new doctor, I'm like, you know what? She's going to make you an expert. You are going to be the best at this because she's going to challenge everything you got there.
Well, she got sick literally right after the surgery. I had the same illness. It was atrocious. It was one of the worst sicknesses I've ever had. Well, a kid like her facing, you know, a surgery that just took place, this is horrible.
And what happens is she's so sick that we are there not for 7 days, we're going into 30 days now. And this is where, now I know, we have the head of the PICU coming in. The chaplains start coming in, the social workers are coming in, and they're all feeling you out. Do you want to continue? And I got to tell you, every night that I was there, because we did not leave her bedside, I was on my knees. And I don't like crying in front of people. So at night, I would storm heaven. And in the morning, I would encourage every one of those that she has a life worth living and she's going to get better. And so as they're feeling me out, they're saying stuff like, hey, you know, what if we need this? You know, if we have other patients come in and we need this room, and what if, you know, this is very expensive. And this is where I say many of you have gotten your kids braces or maybe had them yourself. Guess what? I spent about $4,000 on my daughter's braces. Not one doctor ever said to me, boy, what a waste of time. What a waste of money. It was purely aesthetics. They said, what a great gift for your child. How about the gift of actual life? How about the gift of giving them surgery that is necessary for them to live? So all of these arguments are coming. And, you know, they've always been something out here for me. I've heard this in the pro-life movement. We were pro-life well before we got married. But when it's your child, boy, I tell you, these things hit home. And they're easy for us to combat now. Because then I could say, we got braces for my daughter. Not one doctor ever said it was bad. And I said, certainly the gift of life I'm going to give to her is good too. So nobody bothered us after that. In fact, they became on our side. They really became her advocate.
And so Faith went through this stuff. You can see the jaw distractors and what they did. They distract and they grow the jaw longer. So it opens up her airway so she can breathe. Novel idea, right? Help her breathe. So these are just some fun pictures that we have to, because as we went through this, obviously the family's walking through it. And again, you know, they say the family is going to be destroyed by this. Let me tell you, our children are better for this.
Yeah. They've developed a compassion and a love for others that is exceptional. And it's because we walk through this as a family.
And this picture I just love because they took the distractors off. They were heavy. She just couldn't close her mouth for days. But I want to show you again, here's her before picture, before the distraction. You tell me that a novice doctor couldn't have figured that one out. And yet nobody, till she's almost 3 years old, said anything. Just put it in the medical records. Never said anything. They were going to let that little girl die. That's what they were going to do.
Well, and quite frankly, because over 90% have been aborted, they do not have the skills. They do not know how to identify it. There is no standard of care here. So whereas Down syndrome in the 80s, their life expectancy was much lower than the average person's. But then they started just treating. Hey, if there's a problem with their liver, let's look at their liver. If there's a problem with breathing, let's look at that. And so now they are almost at the typical life expectancy of any individual. And so what's happening here is these trisomy 18 kids, they're living too if they get proper treatment. But again, this is a practice. If they haven't been practicing treating the sick, they don't even know what to do.
And Faith's not supposed to do anything. I mean, she's not. She starts trying to walk after starting to get this oxygen flowing and the air flowing into her. Amazingly, she starts trying to do things that she had never done before. But out of this, we started with this whole Rick Santorum. He was running for president back in 2012, and we got covered by the Detroit Free Press during that campaign. They did a front page story on Faith and our story tied to Rick Santorum. Out of that, we met a friend, and I want you to hear her story.
Breathe, Mila. Breathe. Those were the first words I uttered to my daughter as the doctor sat her on my chest after she was ushered from my womb. Breathe. Please. Breathe. I begged her to breathe. I just wanted her to utter one moan, cry, scream, anything to let me know that she was alive. Mila was purple. Her eyes wide open, no sound, no movement. That was the hardest thing in that moment. I massaged her back, tried to massage her chest, like I'd seen on the many baby birthing shows I watched over the years. The room dimly lit, quiet. Everyone around me seemed to disappear, and it was just her and I. I begged, pleaded for her to cry. Tears formed in my eyes. After what felt like eternity, I handed her off to the nurses, praying for a miracle. I felt so helpless. There was nothing I could do. Then I heard it, the meek sound of my baby. She cried, not a full cry, but a small cry. And it was God's way of showing me that He answered my prayer. Earlier that morning, the neonatologist arrived in my room to discuss what would happen once Mila was born. She explained that once Mila was born, if she wasn't able to breathe on her own, they wouldn't make any attempts to resuscitate her because it would be prolonging the inevitable, and resuscitation wouldn't make things better. I was so upset. I wanted to just jump up and leave. I hated myself in that moment, because I felt like I should have decided on another hospital to deliver my baby. I was upset because I was basically being told that if Mila was not able to breathe on her own or after being bagged, she would be allowed to die. My life was turned upside down in a matter of minutes. I felt so betrayed. I felt so misled. I thought to myself, why develop a birth plan of what I wanted if what I wanted wasn't being honored? I felt no one should have the right to tell me how they were going to treat my daughter. After more discussions, I had to finally accept the fact that my baby would die if she wasn't strong enough to breathe on her own.
She had been told, they knew this was the hospital that wouldn't give us a CPAP. We tried to keep her from going there. But she trusted her doctors. They all knew that this child had trisomy 18 in the womb. Nobody told her that they wouldn't resuscitate her child
until she was in labor. Yeah.
They did this in the middle of her labor. They walked into that room and told her what was going to happen. She couldn't do anything at that point. She was stuck right there. And so you can see this is maddening. And I want you to get a clear picture of this. This is happening all over the country. I could stand up here for another hour and tell you story after story after story from all over the country. And one of them that happened, I'll give you this one real quick, that happened right here in, well, in Ohio. I won't say what city, but at a children's hospital in Ohio. And this family was told that their little girl could not live. And then the NICU doctor, they made themselves, you know, hey, we're going to do everything we can to help you. And when told that their child needed heart surgery, they said, well, she's going to have to get bigger to be able to do it. And then they told her like a pound level that she needed to get up to. And I went, that's not right. So I tried to connect her with my doctors at Mott. And she did have some serious heart issues. But there was one doctor in St. Louis who was willing to do heart surgery for this child. So they were packing up. They were getting everything ready to go. But in leading up to this, this NICU doctor who had been their friend all along, and I kept saying, you got to be careful with these people. You got to be careful. He had been their friend all along. When they started pushing for all these second opinions from all these different hospitals, he came into their room and he was angry with them. They were taken back. They didn't know what to do. He walked in and he said, what are you doing? He said, we have gone above and beyond everything that we ever should have even done for this child. He was never on their side. He was waiting for that little girl to die. That's what he was waiting for. And when it didn't happen, it made him angry. And so seeing all these things, it's infuriating. So I ran across some friends in Minnesota were working on a bill that they wanted to get passed. It was just simply transparency, requiring hospitals, if you're not willing to treat, say you're not willing to treat. That's all it is, transparency. They didn't get anywhere with it. And we started doing research because we wanted to do it in Michigan. So we started working at it. Jesse starts doing this research. And as we do, we run across all kinds of stuff on trisomy 18. But the stuff that's popping up around it is from Germany. And so we want you to watch this video real quick.
Suicide was commonplace in the ancient world, especially for disabled children or visibly deformed children. In fact, the 12 tables of Roman law, which is the foundation of the entire Roman law code, mandates that all visibly deformed or disabled children be killed at birth. The extent to which this was practiced is clear from, for example, the city of Ascalon, the ancient Philistine city. The Roman baths there were excavated a few decades ago, and they discovered under those baths 100 skeletons of children a week old or younger that were just simply discarded. And when you look at any number of ancient writers, whether it's philosophers like Plato or Aristotle, Roman writers such as Tacitus and others, they're all unanimous in saying, you know, look, this is just simply good for the civilization. If we allow the weak to survive, we're going to become weak. Christianity brings in a culture that says that every human life is valuable. And although it takes time, Christianity will eventually change the entire culture of the Roman world, certainly, and well beyond that, away from abortion and infanticide toward this ideal, the preservation of life.
The worldview that every life was valuable was pervasive in Western culture for the next 1,700 years.
Galton and Darwin would be the next major step away from the Christian worldview, actually more toward what amounts to being a pagan worldview. For Darwin, it was a matter of those who are most fit to survive passing on their traits to their children. We can't talk about genes yet because they're not known. Passing on their traits to their children, and those traits gradually improving the species until eventually it evolves into a new one. Now, what that means is that from Darwin's perspective, as he puts it himself, inevitably the civilized races will exterminate, his word, will exterminate the savage races. Francis Galton took Darwin's ideas from The Origin of Species and some other ideas that were floating around in the culture and began to argue that, in fact, what we should do is practice a form of eugenics, that we should, in fact, encourage the race to improve by exterminating the weak, by preventing them from reproducing, because this is the way we can take evolution into our own hands and promote that which will be best for the human race.
By the 1870s, Darwinian thoughts were infiltrating the public health system, and eugenic organizations started to appear in the United States. Eugenics laws led to the forced institutionalizations and sterilization of people with Down syndrome and other intellectual disabilities. Many of these institutions practiced passive euthanasia and lethal neglect. In the name of eugenics, individual doctors began to practice passive infanticide, one newborn at a time. Eugenics was openly supported by prominent scientists, Ivy League scholars, businessmen, politicians, and many other influential people of the times. California became the epicenter for the U.S. eugenics movement. Once fully entrenched in America, they sent booklets promoting eugenics to German officials and scientists. In 1916, Madison Grant, a Yale graduate and wealthy New York lawyer, delivered the eugenics message to the masses with his best-selling book, The Passing of the Great Race. Grant's book was praised by Theodore Roosevelt. The book was translated into German, and Adolf Hitler wrote Grant to let him know that the book is my Bible.
Ideas of euthanasia and infanticide were discussed freely in American society and were advocated by a number of leading intellectuals in America. And those ideas were then picked up by people in Germany.
Hollywood made films promoting eugenics. In 1916, a feature film, The Black Stork, was based on the true story in which Dr. Harry Heiselden let an unfortunate baby die instead of performing a simple surgical procedure to save his life. This film, which played from 1916 to perhaps as late as 1942, and the media coverage surrounding Dr. Heiselden, brought eugenics into mainstream public life. In 1920, Germany adopted a new public health policy and began euthanizing children with birth defects, such as Down syndrome, that were considered incompatible with life. These children were taken from their homes by school buses with boarded-up windows. The parents were told their children were being taken to state-of-the-art treatment centers. They were never seen again.
At the Nuremberg trials, when people were accused of these incredible crimes against humanity, the defense was simply, all we are doing is what you Americans have been advocating for the last 40 years. They are simply putting into practice what Americans had already said should be done.
So we want you to grasp here what we're trying to get across. Is this is so ingrained in our culture. And this is demonic. I mean, really, there's no other explanation for it. It's demonic. And it's something that we faced from the earliest of humanity. And it's eugenics. And it's this idea of just wiping out people who aren't worthy, who aren't considered. So the stories that we're telling you, all these people could pay their bills with their insurance. They had insurance to pay the bills. The hospitals just didn't care. And so we through this research that we were doing, we started running across some other stuff. By the way, this is Hadamar, Germany, where they took, that's the hospital where they took these kids, and they were never heard from again. They were killing them and burning their bodies. And people did actually know what was going on because hair was coming out of the smokestacks and falling on the streets. But you think we're different? 2014. Over 15,000 babies incinerated at Cambridge University Hospital's waste-to-energy plant. We're no different. And this happened in Oregon, too. They were doing some of the same stuff with incinerating bodies. One of the things that we ran across was she was really doing most of this, reading these trisomy 18 journals. And some of the stuff that we ran across were the way they would say things. And again, the stuff that was popping up from the Germans. So the top, see if you can pick which one. The top is life unworthy of life. That's a quote from Germany when they were doing their stuff. Quality of life is what we say. Useless eaters is how they termed it. Now, does this sound a whole lot better? A simply horrible use of scarce medical resources. That's talking about my daughter. scarce medical resources, that it's a waste. So as you look at this stuff, you start to see a pattern. You start to see the things that are coming out. And Margaret Sanger, look at this. We are failing to segregate morons who are increasing and multiplying a dead weight of human waste, an ever-increasing spawning class of human beings who never should have been born at all. Doesn't that sound a lot like what that doctor said? We went above and beyond what we ever should have done for this child?
Well, and I think giving you all these comparisons is because it's much easier to condemn historic atrocities than the ones we allow today. The worst thing is to be a bystander, is it not? We understand there's aggressor, we understand there's a victim, but those of us who sit and watch and do nothing, there's the true horror.
And I can walk through these. The most merciful thing that a large family does to one of its infant members is to kill it. Margaret Sanger. I mean, it's just demented, the stuff. And so we have all these things that are targeting our children, targeting black children. But again, remind you, 90% of these children are aborted. That's huge. We're just wiping them out.
And don't you wonder where they are? I take Faith out all the time. I'm walking her on the street. We literally, in our neighborhood, it was a weird experience. I'm walking her on the street, and this guy literally stops his car, and I think, well, it must be a neighbor. I look in his window. He is staring at Faith. He literally stopped his car. His daughter was right here. He's driving. And I'm looking at him like, and then I realized, nope, he's just staring at Faith. I'm like, oh, okay, bye. You know, we keep walking. I don't know what's... People literally stop and stare because where are they?
You don't see these. I grew up in Ohio, in Allen County. And when I was a kid, we had a school called Merrimore. And they had these little buses. They drove around and they picked up kids, mostly kids, with Down syndrome. That school is gone. It's gone. So we're literally wiping out these children. And we're no different than these people. We're no different. And the reason we say this is we want you to understand this is a fight that we have to wage. And we'll always have to wage this because these people aren't going anywhere. The Nazis, we think they went away. I'm telling you, they didn't go away. They changed uniforms. And they're more deceptive with their message now. And they're actually more efficient with their murder. Hitler would be jealous of what Planned Parenthood is accomplishing today.
Well, and I know this, if I can quote Margaret Thatcher, she said something like this. You think I'm reactionary? Well, this is a lot to react to. And it is. There's certain levels of alarm that do take you certain places. But I think with God, they always take you to the right place. And here's where we went to the right place. We were able to get a law passed in Michigan called the Medical Good Faith Act. The name Faith, of course, we wanted to use in there. And we wanted to make it seem like something positive. We go to the doctors, the hospitals. We ask them to act in good faith. We pay in good faith. And we want them to treat in good faith.
And so we got this thing passed, and we just want to encourage it because we know this is hard stuff that we're talking about, but you can do something. In fact, Faith was chosen by Mott Children's Hospital last year as their face for their fundraising.
She is now 7 years old. So the fetal anomaly that they tagged her with at the beginning, the incompatible with life, we can drop that now. And every time we wheel her in, every doctor we take her to is shocked. I mean, because she's walking in herself. She was not verbal the first 2 years. Her eyes were rolling. So every time they see her, they're seeing this, you know, it's hard to see as the parent, them growing. But they are seeing that, and it encourages them to then keep treating the next child.
And let me tell you, God can do anything, because Jesse is actually even making friends with doctors.
We're killing it on the Star Wars stuff, aren't we? I mean, that's great.
Got to take
We're
advantage
so timely.
Of it. So we go through this because we want you to understand that we can make a difference. We can all push and do something. We can change our society. In fact, I got to tell you, those numbers, I gave you those earlier, one child survives to their first birthday. That doctor, Dr. Green at Mott Children's Hospital, he is an amazing man. And he has actually just written a paper on children with trisomy 18 and how to treat their airways. Understand, this is a white paper. So it was just accepted and is being presented on May 22nd in Chicago at a national pediatric conference. This will go across the hospitals all over the country. But beyond that, this man had said to one of our moms after a surgery that he was thinking about starting a trisomy clinic. And I found that out, and I'm like, we got to talk. We had dinner with him, and I sat there. I'm in sales. I sold him on his own idea.
Have you guys ever been out to dinner with your doctor? They ever take you out? First time we had done it, they ate off our plate. I mean, you know, this is a doctor. He's buying dinner, but they buy dessert, and they're like, you guys have to try this. Here, you try this.
It was hilarious.
They were great. But you know what? When I said she was in the hospital for 30 days, it's because we had to redo that surgery three times. And everything that could go wrong did. And there was a point in there when I knew that God told me to, in front of the whole staff, because the PICU staff was livid. I'm doing this surgery a third time. She's already failing. And I went out there and I said, you know what? You're the only one who even told me what was wrong. You were willing to do surgery. We've hit every bump in the road. And I thanked him in front of that whole staff. From that comes all of this. He now has about 20 patients with trisomy 18 that he treats. She was his first.
We had told him at one point after everything was done, we looked at him and we asked him, we said, will you treat other patients if we send them to you? He said, yes. So we took him at his word, and I looked at him when he said that, and I said, we're going to make you the expert. God is good.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, we can flip this whole thing by putting a trisomy clinic online so that parents can push their doctors and go, they're doing it at Mott Children's Hospital at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. So God can do what he wants to do. And we, if we listen to him and do what we can make a difference. So I just want to encourage you all. We thank you so much for letting us come. And if you want to, you may not want to touch her. She's not feeling great, but Faith is here to say hi. So,
and that's her big sister, Grace.
This is Grace.
Yeah. But when we save the what people, everybody says are the least of these, when we save the one, it protects all of us. You know, this is the harder case to fight. You know, they're kind of the unwanted among the unwanted. But let me tell you, if we win the battle here, we have won the war. And so I would want to encourage you, you know, if we take on children like Faith and we protect them and we become their voice, everyone else will be protected by those same laws.
And this is a battle that we can win, and having faces like her, getting them out there and pushing them, makes all the difference in the world. Yeah. Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For having
Thank
us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Brad and Jesse Smith, who are speakers and authors for Save the One, and founders of the pro-life blog, Little Faith to Big Faith, and 2016 Bringing America Back to Life Convention speakers.